studying the book of Genesis, and I'm on page 164, Genesis 35, 23. Now, there were 12 sons of Jacob, sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon and Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin, the sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, Dan and Naphtali, the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maid, Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. So here is the Toledot of Jacob's 12 sons. The Old Testament is full of Toledot. It's a Hebrew word meaning genealogy. Genealogies. This guy begat this guy, this guy begat this guy. And we often question as to why those things are there. The answer is simple. Toledots were usually used by people who did not have writing. Remember, none of these people had writing till at least 1500 B.C. So for the first 3,000 years, they had not had writing. Toledots are used by people who do not have a written world to help memorize their family tree and the events that occurred at each level. So they would say it was during the time of so-and-so that fire was invented. It was during the time so-and-so began to build cities. And we heard it was during the time of so-and-so Seth that began to call upon the name of the Lord. So that's how they teach their history. Aboriginal peoples today, even still, who don't have written language and written skills, teach their children genealogies and then hang information off of them like a Christmas tree. And that's why the Old Testament's full of them, so that to trace the history of it. Now, all history was orally transmitted by memory until later when books became common. And remember, books actually didn't become common until 1400 AD, after we had the printing press, Gutenberg's printing press. And before that, between, say, 1400 BC and 1400 AD, you had hand copying registers. And at times you had monks, who spent their life in contemplation with God and hand copying registers. You also had a job description in those days we don't have anymore called scribes. Scribes are people who did this very same thing. They copied things for people for a living, or they wrote letters for them for a living. A lot of people could speak in Jesus' day. They could speak Aramaic, Greek, Hebrew, maybe a little bit of Latin, but almost none of them could write. Even people like Peter may not have been able to write, and certainly not much. That's why Peter enlists Mark, young Mark, to write his gospel for him. Paul was very literate, but too busy to write, so he enlists Luke to write the story of his sojourn with him, the book of Acts. Luke is the only Gentile in the Bible, and he was amanuensis for Paul. Peter's amanuensis was Mark. Matthew and John wrote themselves. You know, Matthew was a tax gatherer, which means he was an educated person, and he was able to write his own stuff. Matthew starts off by writing a book of Jesus' sayings, and it existed for hundreds of years and then disappeared. But what he did later was, is he took Mark's historical gospel and wrapped it into his book of saying and added a little bit here to it and created the book Gospel of Matthew. That's how that came about. So Toledots are given because people can't read or write and they need some way to remember their history. Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre in Kiriath Arba. That is what we call Hebron now, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last and died. He gathered to his people an old man ripe of age, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Now if we remember, almost 40 years earlier in this, Isaac thought he was dying, and he called Esau to himself in order to give him the blessing to be able to pass the leadership on to Esau. And here he is dying at 160, 40 years later. So he kind of, his discernment was not long on that area. His discernment wasn't long on a lot of things. Isaac was a good man. His life had been fairly easy. He was the son of a rich man. He didn't even have to go find a wife. They sent somebody to find one for him. We have little or no record of Isaac's sin. It seems that Isaac was basically an obedient son and did pretty much what he was supposed to. The only sin we see in Isaac's life at all is where he would try to tell people that his wife was his sister, which is a trick he learned from his father. A little deceptive, but not much. And he was just a good guy. But because of that, because he was wealthy, and because he was didn't have a lot of interaction with God around his issues, didn't have any, he didn't have much interface with God at all. And therefore, he lacked a lot of discernment. Isaac was unable to discern between his two sons that he'd known for, twin sons for 20 years. He couldn't tell which one was coming in to talk to him. He couldn't discern that. His eyes were bad. Jacob, on the other hand, was something else altogether. He was like his mother. He was deceptive. He was constantly in trouble, deceiving people, tricking people, trying to outsmart people, whatever. One mess after another, getting himself into all kinds of trouble. And because he was in all kinds of trouble, he found himself interfacing with God a lot. God loved Jacob because he valued spiritual things. Esau couldn't care less about that. He was a good old boy and a nice man. I mean, you couldn't hardly fault Esau much, except he didn't have any use at all for God or things spiritual. And so the Bible says that God loved Jacob, and Esau he preferred less. It says he hated, but it means he loved less because Jacob was... But Jacob was a mess. He was broken. He was sinful. The sinfulness broke him. He had one trouble after another. His sons all deceived him. His wives deceived him. And he went through a whole lot, and he was constantly before the Lord, and he developed discernment. So that when Jacob is dying, he is asked to pray by Joseph over two grandsons he's never met. And he's able to discern that the younger one will rule over the older one, in spite of the fact that Joseph is saying, no, that's not how it's supposed to be. He said, no, this is what it's going to be. Jacob had a great deal of discernment. Now, does that mean we should sin that grace might abound? The answer is no. But what it does mean is that God redeems everything in our life. God can take even our mistakes, our sins, our brokenness, and build things in us if we will seek Him. The thing about Jacob was, is in spite of all of his humanity, he loved God and he sought God and he found God, and that caused him to know God. So there's some hope for us in that. If we will take our brokenness before the Lord, He will help us to change, but we'll also get to know Him and who He was. You can't know God if you don't interface with Him. Moses interfaced with God. Noah interfaced with God. Another way to say that is they had a relationship with Him, and all salvation is based in relationship. Esau had no relationship with God. Didn't want one. Couldn't care less. Wasn't sure it was possible. Not a bad guy. He just had no spiritual life at all in him. Finally, Jacob has gone up to Mamre to see his father. He's in a mess, remember? Last time we saw him, his two sons had covenanted with the people of Shechem to be circumcised, and then they'd taken a bunch of thugs in and killed all the men and put Jacob and his family at risk from all the tribes around that area. Jacob has to flee to get away from him to go to Luz or to Bethel. In that process, his favorite wife, Rachel, dies in childbirth to Benjamin. Jacob has got issues. His sons are all deceiving him, and his wives are deceiving him. He's a mess. So he goes to see his father to have a conversation with his father. And then he's with him for a while there in Mamre, where his father lives, and then he dies. Life has gotten tough for Jacob, so he needs to talk to his father. Talk about Isaac having an easy life, less spiritual discernment. Jacob, on the other hand, was more morally flawed. We talked about that. He had a tough life, wrestled with God quite a bit. In the process, however, Jacob gets to know God well. I talked about that too. Our God is redemptive, and He will use even our failures to draw us closer to Him if we seek Him. God wants relationship. And the fact that we're a mess does not disqualify us from God. In fact, it helps us to see our need. One of the people who had a problem with Jesus were not the people who were sinners. They knew they had a problem. It was the people who thought they weren't sinners. They're the ones who had no use for Jesus. They're the ones who found Jesus to be butting in where He didn't belong, etc., etc., etc. All right, Genesis 36. Now this is, the whole chapter is the Toledot of Esau, and it is the entire chapter, and I'm not even going to read it. So it's a record or a lineage of Esau. As mentioned previously, Toledot is a Hebrew term for genealogy. Toledots were usually used to allow people to memorize their family tree and the events that occurred at each level. I think I covered all that. All right, Genesis 37, verse 1. I'm going to page top of 166 there. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. And these are the records of the generations of Jacob. So now we're going to get a recording of Jacob's history, except it's all going to be on one man. He's only going to talk about Joseph. That's all we're going to talk about. It said, these are the records of the generation of Jacob, Joseph. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a very colored tunic, a multicolored coat. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers. So they hated and could not speak of him on friendly terms. Joseph was the favorite son, the 11th son born to him, the son of his favorite wife. And Jacob spends time with him from the very beginning. His older sons are basically worker bees. That's how people tend to relate to their children in those days. We don't have this devotion to children until we get to Jesus. But before that time, children would be seen and not heard. There was a culture. It's almost a law. And people thought of their children as utilitarian. Sons were workers. Daughters were, you were able to use them as leverage to make money for the family or to get title or whatever through marriage. And when men or women fell in love with their children, it was an axiom, it was a thing. It was unusual, it wasn't the norm. We have a tendency to think, well, you know, gosh, how could you not just go crazy over your children? That's because we come out of a Judeo-Christian culture. And remember that Jacob's culture was neither Judeo or Christian, because we don't even get Judaism until much later. So he was part of the culture of the day, the Arab culture, and saw his children as pretty much expendable, except for Joseph, whom he loved. If you look at the culture today in the Arab world, you will see a lot of that. Now, there are people who do like one of their children or another, but a lot of what you see is people with a lot of children, they're fighting each other for position, and a lot of politicking, and you don't think anything about strapping bombs on them and sending them into crowds, get blown up, it's not a... It doesn't strike them the same way it would have us. So he was 17 and he brought back a bad report to his father. The thing about Joseph is he's extremely gifted spiritually. He's bright, he's intelligent, and he's hardworking. He's also very unwise. He is, at this particular point, naive. He's insensitive. And he doesn't pick up on the fact that his brothers are ticked off that every time he comes home, he tells them on them to his father. In fact, they begin to try to avoid having him on the trip with them, even to the point of telling his father they're going to this place to shepherd the sheep and then getting there and moving to another place altogether so that Joseph can't find him when he comes out to the fields. Shepherds were, they valued their sheep, and they didn't eat them right and left. They would have a feast day or something and have a sheep. So somebody's born or something. But they didn't eat mutton every night. You know, that wasn't how they ate. Because it was their flock. It was their livelihood. And the boys would get out there on the march and they'd get hungry and they'd kill a sheep and eat it. And Jacob would get to counting them. There'd be one miss and they'd say, well, a lion got it. Well, Joseph would come home and say, no, it didn't. They had a barbecue one night, you know. And it got him in trouble all the time. And they hated him for it. So Jacob, in his very unwisely, favors Joseph above his brothers immensely. And in that time, because of that, he spends a lot of time with him. And when we see Joseph turning up here a year later as a slave in Egypt, one of the things we see in him is that he's very developed spiritually because he spent so much time with his father. And he has a very strong commitment to God because he spent so much time with his father. Now he's got to learn some wisdom and some sense, but 12 years in prison will do that to you. And to become wise in that regard. He goes through 12 years of difficulty in order to become the man of God he needs to be. There's a lesson in that. We'll get to that later. So he buys his son a multicolored coat. As you can imagine, basically everybody was wearing burlap-ish stuff or stuff made of skins or whatever. It wasn't like it was... The women might have some cloth to make some dresses, but they certainly didn't wear them outside. You know, they were for parties and dancing and stuff. And so most people's stuff was basically brown, leathery, and hairy, and whatever. And if you had a multicolored coat, something that had all these decorative and whatever, that sets you apart as a big shot. And so his father gave him one of these when he was young. Most fathers did not start recognizing sons until they were old. They certainly didn't start adopting them until they were old. It was when Jacob and Esau were 20 that Isaac decides it's time to adopt Esau so that he can become the head of the tribe. And here Jacob's already bestowed this honor on him at age 12, and has angered his brothers, particularly Reuben, who is the firstborn, and feels like he has been cheated. We saw earlier that Reuben had entered into an adulterous relationship with Bilhah, who was Jacob's concubine and Joseph's nurse. She's about 15 years older than him, but he has entered into a relationship with her so that he can get control or mastery over Joseph, because she's the one that does that. Well, that doesn't work. That backfires on him. So Jacob was obviously the favorite. He was treated specially at the expense of the others. He grew up self-absorbed, spoiled, and therefore unloved by all but Jacob. However, the close and exclusive relationship with his father made him the beneficiary of all that Jacob had learned in his dealings with God, which was a significant treasure trove that will stick to him in the times of trouble to come. Joseph was also endowed by God with brains and beauty and spiritual insight. He was like Muhammad Ali. He's a very pretty man. He's a very pretty man. Had Jacob spent more time with his other sons, he and they would have fared better. Jacob saw his other sons largely as laborers. Their relationship with Jacob was semi-adversarial at best. We're going to see that when push comes to shove, they get down and dirty with their father. He failed to properly honor their mothers. Remember, he favored Rachel over Leah publicly and dishonored Leah by treating her as if she was just somebody he had in his house. She was his first wife, but he treated her differently. And, of course, the concubines, they fell into the same category. Rachel he loved and spent time with and honored above the other three wives. So, there's a mess here. He blamed Simeon and Levi for Rachel's death. Because he had to run and flee from Shechem, Rachel went into labor early and died on the road giving birth to Benjamin, and he had to bear in a ditch or a field somewhere in an unmarked grave. Later, when Leah dies, he bears her in the cave of Machpelah along with Abraham, Isaac, their wives, himself later. So he blames Simeon and Levi for that. And in Genesis 49, when we hear Jacob giving his last will and testament and going over each of his sons and what he gives to them, he smacks Reuben, Simeon, and Levi for these very things and passes over them in terms of the leadership of the tribe because of this. He later takes the death of Joseph out on his sons, and he ruins Benjamin irreparably with his grief. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over? You think you're going to get away with ruling over us, pipsqueak?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now he still had another dream related to his brothers and said, "Lo, I had another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." He related to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow down ourselves down before you to the ground?" So even Jacob was offended by this dream. And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in his heart, his mind. I wonder what this means. He sees this kid has words from God, and what does this mean? His spiritual gifts are extraordinary, but he's immature at this point. He's insensitive to the implication of his dreams, and for the most part, he's casting his pearls before swine. They don't want to hear about his dreams. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock at Shechem. Remember Shechem? By now it's a ghost town. They go back to Shechem to pasture flocks there. They actually have land there. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem?" Israel, of course, means Jacob. He said, "Aren't they in Shechem? Come and I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." So he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers, the welfare of the flock, and bring me back word. I need a report and what they're up to. What's the condition of the flock? Are they doing a good job or not? Come tell me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They have moved on from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Jacob went after his brothers, and he found them at Dothan. Oh, good. He caught them. That wasn't what they wanted. And when they saw him from a distance before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. I would say they're a little upset. I sense some hostility here. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer now. Then come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him." That's the same excuse they use for the dead sheep, remember? Yeah. The wild beast. Boogeyman got him. "Then let us see what becomes of his dreams then." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands. So Reuben's the firstborn. He wants to be the firstborn. He's trying to recover what he's lost with his father for being the firstborn. "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood, throw him into this pit in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him." Of course, Reuben had in mind that he would rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. He's saying, "Look, I don't mind if you rough him up and everything, but let's don't kill him." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped him of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him. He's wearing his Sunday clothes around in the field. Yeah. That was true in the culture in general, all the way up to and including the time of Christ. They were always jockeying for position. Remember, it's tribal, and the father appoints the tribe to the leadership of one son, and everybody else has to bow down to him. So when the father dies, or as he's getting older, he makes one of the sons his heir. He adopts him, so they called it. And then all the other sons have to bow down to him just like they did to their father. So yes, there was jockeying for position, trying to get favor. Remember, we have Jesus having a guy come up to him and say, "My brother won't share the inheritance with me. Would you rebuke him for that?" So even there, Jesus has got somebody in his midst whose brother won't share the inheritance. So yeah, Jesus is talking to his disciples. Don't lord it over one another. That's how the Gentiles do this. Prefer one another. Show love for one. Be humble toward one another. Jesus is teaching a new gospel, a new idea. Be kind to one another. Be nice.
There aren't much in the way of records about Jesus' interaction with his own brother.
Well, except that we know that James, his oldest younger brother, was competitive with him for theological reasons. Remember, James, we're told that James's brothers and sisters did not follow Jesus during his lifetime ministry, but only came to him after his resurrection. They came to take him away. They came to take him. You know, you're nuts. You need to go back home with us. Carpenter shop needs some help, you know. But Jesus rebuked them and dissed them in front of everybody. They said to him, "Your brother and your mothers and sisters are here to speak to you." And he said, "Who are my mother and my brothers and sisters? Are they not those who do the will of my Father's in heaven?" I mean, that was a slam in the face. At one point, they say to him, "If you have a valid ministry, then go down to Jerusalem and present it to the elders there, and they will approve it or not, and then your ministry will be valid." And Jesus said, "I'm not going to do that. I don't want to submit myself to those people." So, no, we have a lot of evidence that they didn't think much of him. And even later, when James finally comes to the conclusion, because after he's the head of the church, he's still got people going out telling Gentiles they need to become Jews. And when it becomes obvious that they don't because of Peter and Paul's testimony, grudgingly, James says, well, okay, we're saved by grace through faith. Let's say amen. And the problem with James is he's heard this before, because it's the argument that he and Jesus would have had at the table. James is a Pharisee. He believes we're saved by works, good deeds, keeping the law. Jesus believes in salvation through relationship with the Father, obedience to the Father, and all that sort of thing. And he doesn't think keeping the law is even possible. And so the older brother and the second older brother, they've been living together for better part of 30 years. And their dialogue around the table is going to be one's taking this position, one taking the other. So when James writes what is the first epistle that ever goes out at all, it's in order to clarify his position. He's got to do two things. First, he's got to acknowledge to all of his followers that we are saved by faith through grace and not by works, lest any man should boast. He's got to acknowledge that, because it's just true. And as much as he hated to acknowledge it, he didn't give it to Jesus when they were at home. And, you know, he didn't follow Jesus when Jesus was teaching. It is only after the resurrection that he began to follow him. And even then, he didn't. There was no conversation about Gentiles. And when the Gentiles come in, James says, they got to be Jews. And then he comes to find out they don't after all. And so he writes the Epistle of James, the first one, the first anything's written, for the Gospels, anything, out to all of his followers and to the Gentile church, because he's now the Papa. The Pope, he's now the Papa of the Christian people. And he said, okay, we are saved by faith through grace, not by works, lest any man should boast. I get it. But if you have real faith, you will have real works. See? So he'll grant you that you must be saved by faith, not by works. But he won't grant you that you can get by without works. Because he believes with all of his heart that real faith will produce real works. And he's right. So when he writes his first epistle, it is by way of concession to what Jesus has taught and what Paul's teaching, but with an emphasis on the fact that that notwithstanding, we still have to have works as a demonstration of that real faith. Yes. James' brother John was dead by then. James' brother John was the first martyr among the apostles. Fourth chapter of Acts, he's dead. And he becomes nobody in history. I mean, I don't mean to put that wrong, but no, James, the Lord's brother, is James who's head of the church. And he's the one who writes the epistle. James' brother John dies early.
Isn't it believed that some of James' work was found in Egypt? Is that the Kodak?
There's all kinds of stories about that in the world out there, some of which may be true and some of which won't. But remember that these people eventually went out to all the world, and they would take copies of letters and stuff like that with them. So I don't know enough of that history to chase him down that far. Yeah, brother?
So the head of the household, it didn't necessarily need to be the first son.
No.
No,
the one you adopted. Remember, the word adopt in the ancient world meant the one that you made the heir. So when Paul says we are adopted, he's not saying we're second class citizens who are adopted after the Jews. He's saying God has made us his heir. We're adopted. That's a big news in Paul's world. So no, what happened is a father would wait until the sons were pretty much grown before he would adopt one. Because he wanted to see if they were capable of protecting the tribe and maintaining it. It's like giving your family business. You want to give it to the son who actually will run it and make it better, not to the guy who will waste it and spend it. So what happened is a father would not adopt a son until late in the game, which meant that the sons were always kind of scrapping to get his favor. It put the father in a position of having all the sons sucking up to him, as it were, trying to get his favor. So, and because they wanted to be adopted. Now, when he adopted someone, everybody else had to kowtow to him. He now controlled the family money. He now decided who got what. He now decided, you know, where everybody, where they lived, and all, he said all that. Now, that wasn't just in the Hebrew world, that was in the world. So Julius Caesar, who has sons of his own, adopts his nephew Octavius, because Caesarion, his son, and the only son he had by a wife, was not capable of keeping the empire together, and none of his other sons had the political clout for it. But Octavius, his nephew, did, and he becomes Augustus Caesar. So the process of adoption goes on and on and on. And frankly, that went on to nearly modern times. In the English-American culture, the firstborn son got the estate. The secondborn son, he might get the parish, the cleric. He might become the cleric for the parish, which is in the estate. Any third-born son would probably go to the army or the navy at about age 12 to become a career there. Yeah.
So then it evolved and changed. Is that because of the Church of England and the split or whatever? I mean,
and it's not just English. The Germans did it that way. The Italians did it that way. They all did, Medici's and all that kind of stuff. But now what happened is the firstborn could become disowned. That would happen sometimes. Firstborn sons would tick their fathers off, and he would disown them. It would be a public thing. He disowned them. And that made the secondborn son the guy. Now, what happened with most people who had wealth is they wanted to make sure they had an heir and a spare. So if you had William, you had to have Harry in case something happened to William. Because remember, Edward is the firstborn, became the king of England, then abdicated, so they had to have George, who was the least likely to become king and wanted it less. You got to have the spare. Yes, sir. That's a term for it, yeah. He's the kinsman redeemer. He's the kinsman who is able to redeem you if you get into trouble.
And they have the option of abdicating.
Oh, sure. They can abdicate, and typically what would happen is any wise father would pick the right son for the sake of. It's like when King David was on his deathbed, you know, he'd already had two sons die trying to steal the throne. And Adonijah was in the process trying to steal the throne, and he had promised that he would adopt Solomon, and Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet went in and told David that Adonijah was trying to steal the throne. And so he appointed Solomon king while he still lived. And that put Adonijah on the outs. In fact, Adonijah was afraid for his life. But throughout history, you see co-regents. You see a king, and when he's older, he'll anoint his son king, and they rule together. That's why when you do some of the math on the kings, you say this guy reigned 40 years, and then this guy reigned, you know, 37 years or whatever. What you don't realize is that the first 7 years of the second guy were in the last 7 years of the first guy. And so that when you do your historical records and stuff, you have to keep track who's co-reigning at any particular point in time. And to some extent, we do that too. You know, who would you pick as the executor of your estate, for instance? The son who's likely to blow it in Vegas, or the son who's likely to make sure your will gets done the way you want to and that everybody's treated fairly, you know? So if you say, well, the firstborn should be the executor, that could be a dumb decision, right? Or if you say the favorite should be the executor, that can also be a dumb decision. So we have the same issues at some level. And we also have the same issues about our daughters. I mean, we have a whole different world today in which daughters tend to marry whoever they want, theoretically. Most of the world, for most of history, have been arranged marriages. And some marriages, arranged marriages, are like when they're born, whenever. Some arranged marriages, though, go along the lines of the high-toned Smiths and the high-toned Johnsons agree that their children will marry so that that dynasty can go forward. Sometimes you see daughters pressured to marry this guy because he's a senator or something, as opposed to this guy because he's a carpenter. You get this whole prejudice against anybody who's going to marry down to somebody as opposed to who can marry up, however that's perceived to be. This guy, you know, he went to Ivy League. You need to marry him. And you see a lot of this intermarriage among the upper class, which is basically influenced by the same thing we're talking about. Now, if you watch Downton Abbey, Mary had to marry somebody who could refund the estate. Just like Lord Grantham had to marry the rich girl from America to refund the estate because he'd run out of money. So, you know, and Elizabeth and whatever, they could marry whoever they wanted, you know, preferably some notable, but Mary had to, because they had to refund the estate. So that's the world, you know, much of the world, even up to until today. And what we're seeing here is just a manifestation of that at a very basic level. Other comments? Okay. They took him and they put him in a pit. And it was empty and had no water in it. Well, that was nice. Then they sat down to eat a meal. This is cold-blooded, you know. And they raised their eyes and looked, and behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites were coming from Gilead. So here comes some traders, some Arab traders, Ishmaelites, with all their earrings on and their bells on their camels. And Judah, the firstborn, said to his brothers, "What does it profit us if we kill him? Why don't we sell him and make something off of it?" So where do these stereotypes come from?
What kind of wild beasts do they have roaming the countryside in those days?
Oh, wolves, bears. And probably some we don't even know about today. Lions, not tigers.
Lions?
Well, David is the king of, is the Lion of Judah.
Okay.
Remember, in Israel, when Israel was emptied out by Babylon, one of the problems they had was lions overtook the city of Jerusalem, and the people who lived there prayed and asked their false gods how to get rid of the lions, and they said, "You're not honoring the king of the God of the Jews. And if you want the lions to go away, you need to honor the God of the Jews." And so they did. So, no, yeah, lions are a big part of the deal. They're snakes, Democrats, they're all kinds of people. So Judah said, "What does it profit us for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our own blood." This is our brother. We shouldn't kill our own brother. You know, that's cold. Let's sell him.
Yeah.
So, and the brothers listened to him, and some Midianite traders passed by. So they pulled him up and they lifted Joseph out of the pit and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit later. Reuben's not around during the sell-off. So he goes back to the pit, and his idea is he's going to take the kid out, take him back home, and give him to his father. And behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his garments, like in mourning. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go? What am I going to do? I'm the firstborn. This is my responsibility. What am I going to do?" And they took Joseph's tunic, and they slaughtered a male goat, and they dipped the tunic in the blood, and they sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine to see whether it's your son's tunic or not." We were on our way home, and there over in the rocks was this thing, is all bloody and torn and whatever, and we think it might be Joseph's. Remember, this is Jacob the deceiver. These are his sons. Okay. Then he examined and he said, "It's my son's tunic, and the beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son for many days. He mourned and he mourned and he mourned and he mourned. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him to Egypt. In Egypt, to Potiphar, the Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So Reuben moves to save the boy from death. As the firstborn, he thinks in terms of tribal leadership. His vain hope for the future, maybe if he rescues Joseph from death, he'll get the job. He hopes to rescue Joseph and return to Jacob unharmed. He probably hopes this will make up for his dalliance with Bilhah. The others decide to have dinner before fratricide. A pretty cold behavior. Judah sees the opportunity to get rid of Joseph permanently without murder, and Namdergelt at the same time. Make some money, Namdergelt. Get the money. Where do we get these stereotypes? The favorite son is now sold off in slavery in Egypt, where he's going to have a whole different life than he's had before. He's 18 years old. And he's going to be there for 12 years in slavery. And he's doing that because that's what God allowed to happen to him. Because God wants to develop him into a man of God, as opposed to the self-centered fellow that he is, immature, and he's talented and gifted and all those things, but he's in no condition whatsoever to rule and reign with Christ, with God.
It's just 20 shekels of silver. Huh? What would that be worth today?
100 bucks, 200 bucks, I don't know. It wouldn't be 10,000, and it wouldn't be $5. I don't know.
That's used elsewhere.
A shekel was 88 cents to the dollar when I was in Israel.
Well, that's today's shekel, but...
Shekel.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be 20 of today's shekels. It'd be like 2,000 of today's shekels. So the biblical shekel, it's worth so much in gold, and who knows how much that's worth at that time.
I'm just wondering if the brothers came back and says, hey, let's go buy something. Let's go to the mall and buy something. And, you know, somebody says, well, where'd you get all that money?
Yeah. Well, nobody would apparently noticed. Nobody noticed. Because Jacob, 12 years later, Jacob, 19 years later, after Joseph becomes the Pharaoh's guy, and there's 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine. You know, it's beginning to be 7 years of famine. 19, 20 years later, when they run out of food, Jacob is sending them to Egypt to get food 20 years later, and he's still snarly mean about what happened to Joseph, and he won't let Benjamin go. He's still got that. And later he tells Pharaoh, my life has been nothing but misery. Nothing but misery, man. Yeah.
How God has intervened in all this. It's like he gave Joseph, even though there was a lot of parenting issues, he really installed, there was so much in Joseph that Jacob knew. You know what I mean? Jacob poured himself into Joseph. God knew Joseph was going to need all of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you see also his favor and all the problems Joseph incurred because of that favor, and how God's going to work all that out through the hardship that he's going to go through.
This is important to understand. When Jacob is spoiling Joseph, that's not pleasing God. But God can use it. God redeems whatever goes on in our life if we will let him. It doesn't mean he approved of what caused that. So, you know, I mean, I might have been in prison 4 times and this and that, and I'm on my 5th marriage and whatever. And then I get my head straight and I start walking with God, and he gives me a ministry to the heathen. Because I got all this testimony, whatever. That doesn't mean he was glad that I had the horrible beginning. He just knows how to take lemonade and make lemons and make lemonade out of it. And he's got a very interesting recipe for chicken salad. Okay? So he can take what we do and screw up, and if we will let him, he will redeem it and turn it into strength for us. Now the other thing is you don't build muscle without effort, without grist, without pain, no pain, no gain. And in order to build strength into us, he needs to put us through difficulties. That's what he did to Jacob. Jacob eventually, when he gets to Bethel, becomes a man of God. He's 20, 30 years old at that time. Becomes a man of God. But now he's got to live with all of his mistakes that are coming home to roost. But it was all his trouble that did that. And it goes on and on and on in his life. So God uses the trouble in our lives in order to develop us into mature people who can accomplish things. Yes. Did he have enough trouble in his life?
But, and this applies to Kitty's prayer about the bad God reaction that people have. It's not only this century, it's forever.
Forever, yeah.
And the message of become stronger Christians through adversity is actually, if you use it, a gift, a blessing from God.
Yes.
It is, but it's often just not looked that way.
No, that's right. In our immaturity, we don't look at it like that. We think the culture teaches us that if God is here, he's here to make our life happy. And he's here to make everything work out. And when he doesn't, then we're upset with him. And yet, you know, Jesus said, why do you roll your tribulation? The truth of the matter is that if we raise our children that way, if we make sure they're nothing but happy, they're going to turn out a wreck. If we, on the other hand, make our children work, face up to their mistakes, or put them through the very difficult times, teach them not to whine over stitches, or teach them to man up over stitches, teach them to trust God in difficult circumstances, if we use the difficulty in their life to train them, they will become strong, mature people and be able to handle things. So yeah, you're exactly right. There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing new under the sun.
You want to know what the shackles were?
And then, yeah.
It says it's impossible to know its worth in biblical times, but a half a shekel would be worth, with silver at $17 per ounce, a half a shekel is worth $5. So
in biblical times?
Is, no, today.
Oh, today.
A whole shekel would be $10,
yeah.
And it wasn't at 20?
Yeah.
So it's $200.
$200.
A ton of money in those days.
But that's, but no, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
That's a ton of money.
If you take that backwards, it's a lot of money. But it's not 10,000.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It was about what you said.
Yeah, today would have been worth about $200, but back then it would have been worth a lot more than that.
Like a year's pay then.
Pardon?
A year's pay or more.
Don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't honestly know. Yeah.
Isn't that 20 shekels?
Yes, it's used as the price of a slave. So you can buy a male slave with 20 shekels of silver. But no, in fact, in Genesis, in Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, which we never study, it's the price of a slave. So that, you know, what is the cost to buy a man for his life? That's what it's worth. Benjamin gets favored along the lines. For instance, in the days of King David, King Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. And Benjamin and Judah always sort of clung together because they flowed out of Rachel. Somebody pray us out, please.